It's lovely to be here and to be in conversation with Behrouz, who, for many of us who have been in the world of working on Iran and studying in Iran, studying Iran and writing on Iran, he has been our mentor and he has been the one who has sort of led the way. And I've been in conversations with him since I was an early graduate student. And as soon as he asked and said that this book was coming out and would I be willing to do this conversation with him tonight, I told him, as I always do, that anything Behrouz asks, I always say yes. So it's lovely to be here. I want to start with, you know, I read this when Olivia first sent me this book a few months ago, and I underlined, I was thinking it through, and then I reread it a few days ago to prepare for tonight, and I couldn't get away from this notion of your writing on the long war in Iran, and I don't know if the current moments we're in will be the last war on Iran or not. I kind of feel like it won't. But how does it feel to have this book come out with this title, with the type of trajectory that you're drawing in this particular moment?
First of all, thank you, everyone, for being here. I just wanted to say a few words about how the book came about. And then, you know, last year, in the middle of the genocide in Gaza, a friend of mine, many of you might know him, Elias Khoury, who passed away a few months after I had that conversation with him, asked me to write a piece about what was happening in American universities in the midst of genocide in Palestine. And all these censorship and crackdown and securitizing the universities. And I thought, okay, that would be a nice thing because he wanted to publish it in Beirut so the Arab readers can sort of see what's going on in the U.S. And so I was looking at my files and I bumped into this piece I wrote in 2014, 10 years earlier, called Bombing in Gaza Destroys American Universities. And I thought to myself, how come I've written this 10 years earlier? And immediately this phrase came to mind, new events, old questions. And this new events, old questions was the title of a very short essay Lenin wrote in 1902. And I thought that, you know, if you read Lenin when you are a teenager, Lenin would never leaves your mind, you know. I'm always there. And I thought that this is such an appropriate kind of title for a book of how many times we've been in this situation, the events that unfold, but the questions remain the same. It's a question of genocide. It's a question of justice. It's a question of colonialism. It's a question of imperialism. And then I started looking at these old essays I had written in the past 20 years. And one after another was exactly the same thing. Like in 2004, 20 years earlier, I wrote this piece called Are Iran and the U.S. on Collision Course? You know, and at that time, I said that Iran and the U.S. are facing a war, you know, 20 years ago. And so the title of the book, you know, The Long War on Iran. And of course, I had no idea whether these essays had any intellectual or political value. I put them together and I contacted Colin. Colin is standing right there. And I said that, you know, I have these essays, my work for 20 years. Do you think that they could be published as a book, you know? So Colin was very excited. So that's the story of the book. And then, you know, we worked on it with the staff at OR Books. We tried to figure it out how to put them together to make sense. And of course, one of the challenges of the book was to write an introduction for this book during the time that the world has become so uncertain. Every single day that I sat there to write something, I realized that we are going to be living in a different world by the time this book comes out. And I actually wrote three different introductions to this book. And finally, I don't know whether it was Colin or one of the editors told me that enough is enough. You have to write an introduction, so we need to get the book published. So I had no idea that the book would come out during these tragic times. Intellectually, I thought that this war was inevitable. Based on years of studying the US politics, Iranian politics, Iran-US relations, I thought that this is inevitable. We're going to reach that moment. But in my guts, I thought that's not going to happen. And it was a denial in my guts that I thought that, you know, this war is impossible. Because the thought of it was so unbearable, especially seeing the genocide in Gaza. Because I think that the rules of war had changed after October 7. And this war in Gaza changed the logic of war. Every possible person, every possible building, every possible neighborhood became a legitimate target after that war. And we see how it's unfolding in Tehran and other Iranian cities at this moment. So although intellectually I thought this is going to happen, but somewhere in my gut I thought that, please God, do I believe in God? I don't know. But I said, please God, don't let this happen. But it happened, and it's quite unfortunate that the war coincided with the publication of this book. But if you read the introduction of the book, I do mention that when the book comes out, we might be in a situation of all-out war between the U.S. and Iran. So that's where we are.
You also write in the introduction of the book that Western observers often frame the formation of the Iranian security state as a reflection of chronic paranoia. And I remember these conversations that I had with you earlier on in my graduate career about when I was doing my work in Iran and my field work in Iran, and I kept saying, they're so paranoid. And you and my PhD advisor kept saying to me, there are reasons for paranoia. Dig into those reasons and try to explain those. And you do that. I mean, for me, what was so fascinating reading some of the all of your essays together and reading them in succession as you had sort of, you and your editors had created the timeline of this book. One left me with this feeling of, I had to put the book down multiple times to be like, wow, I can't believe, first of all, I had forgotten those moments, even though they weren't that many years ago, because it feels like we're in such a different world today. But also, my God, how things have shifted and how things have changed, and how in some ways the paranoia has proven and has played out. So I want to ask you about digging past that paranoia to sort of help. And what you do and have done in all of your work is to kind of show the complexities within Iranian politics and society. And at the same time, what was it like to revisit these old essays and to have this mirror up to yourself about, wow, I used to think that, do I still think that today? Or how what I used to think, like you said in your opening remarks, has come to be true?
One of the sources I always consult is the National Security Archive, that once in a while they release declassified documents. And some years ago, I bumped into this document about Cuba, and the CIA analyst there was saying that Fidel Castro was very paranoid because he thought constantly that the U.S. is trying to kill him. I'm serious, you know. And I thought, well, the U.S. tried to kill him like 19 times, you know. If somebody thinks that you're trying to kill him and you actually are trying to kill him, that person is not paranoid. That person is realistic. And that's the situation of Iran, I think. And there is this short book by one of the so-called Iran experts, that my colleague Negar Razavi is there, she knows him, that the whole book about how paranoid Khamenei is, the supreme leader, that he constantly thinks that the U.S. is trying to overthrow his regime. You know, like, if the U.S. is trying to overthrow your regime, then that doesn't make you paranoid. But then, you know, it created a situation that I realized, and you can see in different sections of the book, because we clustered the essays in different sections on U.S.-Iran relations, Iranian domestic politics, the structures of power in Iran, and American domestic politics. Because I wanted to show that it's impossible to understand the Iranian regime without situating it in relation to American politics. It's basically impossible for all of us who understand Iranian state to be a repressive regime. We cannot understand that repression without situating it in relation to Iran and U.S. relationship. A lot of these issues are brought up again and again in the past 20 years in these essays. And I tried always to make that argument that it is true that kind of repression that constantly is exercised against women in Iran, against labor movement in Iran, against the student movements in Iran. They're all true, but you cannot understand that without that kind of concern about the possibility of regime change or overthrow of the regime, which is designed by the CIA, by Mossad, and all other external factors, agents inside Iranian politics. And one of the reasons, actually, I wanted to put together these essays in a book form was to highlight that point, that it is impossible, actually, to go back to these moments to remember that, for example, in 2004, I was actually in Washington, D.C., a week before invasion of Iraq. Center for Strategic Studies invited me with a couple of other people to talk about the situation in the Middle East. And I thought that they wanted to talk about Iraq. And I went there and they said, okay, what do you think that we should do with Iran? I said, well, excuse me, what's happening? You know, is it the plan to invade Iraq? And in their mind, Iraq was already done a week before the invasion. And that famous kind of epithet that boys go to Baghdad and real men would go to Tehran was so strong in Washington, D.C. at the time. And it's very interesting, in one of the essays here I wrote in 2004, that a group of Iranians, some Iranian colleagues and friends are here, and now Iranian diaspora here are so desperate to say the U.S. should attack Iran to change the regime. In 2004, exactly the same kind of argument that Iran should submit to U.S. demands, otherwise the U.S. would invade Iran exactly the way they invaded Iraq. And if they don't, the responsibility goes to the Iranian government. And exactly the same kind of argument today. It's impossible, therefore, to think about the situation in Iran without this kind of interaction, without this kind of context, that the politics that is operating between U.S., Iran, Israel, politics of the region, and so on and so forth.
You wrote in your introduction that the majority of Americans believe that the U.S. is a benevolent force for good and that it has a moral authority to lead the rest of the world toward a better future. Many Iranian dissidents subscribe to this American myth in a sharp departure from the anti-imperialist position of those who led and participated in the revolutionary movement of the 1970s. And then you go on later to say that these critics fail to recognize that so long as Iranian national interests remain in conflict with those of the Israelis and the Americans, Iran would be demonized regardless of the character of the state that rules the country. And so I want to have you reflect for us a little bit more on, first of all, these kinds of generational shifts that happen from your generation that led to the revolution, that had these very particular anti-imperialist ideas of what the United States meant, to later, as we move into a world in which the U.S. is the unipower of the world, and there is either within Iran or many other places around the world, this idea that through the NGOification of our societies, we can all eventually become these kinds of liberal democracies, and that that took the critical thought about power relations out, and that now we're in a situation in which these bombs are falling on Iran, are being dropped in these carpet bombing ways. These generational ups and downs and their relationship with the United States and the thought of what the U.S. represents in the world in this particular moment, and how do you see those sort of connecting with each other?
Wow, that's a hard question. I truly believe that the idea of the white man's burden is so strong in Western societies. This was the guiding light of many of the colonial expansions. And this idea that the West is the liberating force, and if the rest of the world want to develop and be civilized, is only through the external intervention of colonial forces then Western civilization needs to be brought in to these societies from outside. And I do believe that many Iranians who came to the U.S., and I believe it's not only Iranians, many immigrants who come to the U.S. and they're exposed to the hegemonic culture in Western societies, they subscribe to that view. And in order to be civilized, so-called civilized, one needs to become Western. And I think that that's the sort of the ideological cultural issue that needs to be overcome in order to change this kind of mentality, this kind of ideology. I think that one of the issues that I try to address in the book and in your question is that the revolution in Iran had three major demands. The major demands were about, first, social justice. This idea of social justice, which was very much inspired by socialist ideas. You might be surprised when, if you look at the first constitutional assembly after the revolution, which was an Islamic constitutional assembly, when they were drafting the constitution, one of the issues that they were debating whether or not to include in the constitution was that the difference between lowest and highest income should not increase above 1 to 3, right? I mean, we talk about idealism, right? And so issue of social justice was very, very key in the Iranian revolution. The question of freedom was very much important at the center of this revolution. And the question of sovereignty was very important, because the revolution in Iran, although it was against monarchy, it was against tyrannical rule of the Shah, but it was always inherently an anti-imperialist revolution. Iranians, from my childhood, I remember, like, even first grade in elementary school, everybody knew that the U.S., the CIA, and the British committed a coup in 1953 to overthrow Mossadegh and against nationalization of oil, and then brought back the Shah from Rome in Italy and created the 25 years of what in Iranian political culture is known as the years of dark tyranny. So it was given. We didn't need to wait for the declassification of documents to know that the CIA was involved in the coup. Everybody knew. It was common knowledge. And inevitably, with that common knowledge, any revolution against the Shah was automatically an anti-imperialist revolution. There was no separation. There was not a dichotomy there. So after the revolution, I mean, there are a lot of ups and downs, and those of you who are interested, oh, I forgot, I don't teach anymore, but I was going to say that, you know, you can take my classes, but you can take...
Or buy your book.
But you can take, now, I guess it's classes at SAIS in D.C. to realize that there are a lot of issues happening, but what happened was questions of social justice and freedom, liberty, civil liberties went out of the window very fast. The only thing that remained very strong was the question of sovereignty. And sovereignty in this case was actually the issue that was very, very unpleasant to the U.S. and the Western allies. Again, when I say that sovereignty became important, if the Islamic Republic is a sovereign state, it doesn't mean a support of the Islamic Republic, but it does mean that it's not a client state of the United States. And the entire project of the United States, Israel, and the Western allies is to recreate a pre-Iranian revolution map of the Middle East and to create a client state there. This is what this war is all about, to create either a client state or a failed state. I mean, that's sort of the difference between the Israeli and American projects there, that the Israelis really want a failed state in Iran. Americans, I don't know what Trump wants, who knows? Trump doesn't know what Trump wants. But in general, American policy was to sort of a regime change and to recreate a client state there. So one issue always remained constant is in the past 46 years, 47 years, and that's the question of sovereignty for Iranians. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. And I think this is not an easy question to deal with because exactly of the nature of the state in Iran, the repressive part of the state in Iran. But nevertheless, I think that question of sovereignty is one of the key central issues in what is going on at this point.
So with, you know, very recent comments made by Secretary Rubio and Trump himself with the Monroe Doctrine, you know, updating the Monroe Doctrine of the 19th century into on Latin America, and whereby sovereignty doesn't mean anything there as well. And obviously we've seen Gaza and now this illegal attack on Iran in which the sovereignty of the country was violated in violation of international law. One of the spines of your essays in this book is sanctions as a major obstacle to sort of American power and these decades of sanctions on Iran. And one of the ways as I was reading your book and as I've been thinking about sanctions myself for a while now is how sanctions impoverish the people on the ground to such an extent, whether in Iran, whether in Cuba, whether in Venezuela, whether in all of these other spaces, in which, in essence, it makes sovereignty become a costly thing for the population to even want to desire anymore, right? That they make sovereignty be something that you begin to wonder, is it even worth it anymore? If my life, if my family's life is becoming so poor, if everything around us is so difficult. And oftentimes it's said that, you know, sanctions don't work. And I think part of what you're trying to show here is, and I want this to know this from you, is are sanctions policies actually working? Like if it leads to these kinds of moments in which we now have both in diaspora and within Iran contingencies of the population that actually do want invasion, they don't mind going back to a client state status because they think that at least that way their lives will, and economic situations will be better. And how does sanctions figure into this and figure into this question of sovereignty?
Yeah. If you want to know about sanctions and how they operate, just read Nargis's book, How Sanctions Work, co-authored with three other colleagues. Fantastic book. And it goes through different spheres of how sanctions actually operate in a very empirical way, not from a sort of a political position, but from economic position, from social level and social integration and disintegration. And it's very rich in empirical data. So I would ask you to read Nargis's book. And she didn't ask me to say that. You know, I just came up with that brilliant idea myself, you know. But sanctions are such a key issue because I had this conversation with, believe it or not, director of Army Intelligence when I was at Princeton. When you're at Princeton, you get a chance to talk to those kind of people as well. You know? They would never, ever come here, you know. Colin has invited many of them. They never come, you know. And I actually told him that, let me put it this way. What is the stated objective of these sanctions? the stated objective always is that we want to promote democracy, right, through sanctions, and we want to pressure the governments to respect the demands of their own people and to respect the international law. And through this pressure, we want to force them to come to negotiating table and so on and so forth. I said, okay, that's your stated objective. But let me tell you how it actually operates in practice, right? And of course, you know, in practice, one important thing is that sanctions create a very vast network of crony capitalism. Because if the government feels like they can't sell their natural resources, like oil, basically 80% of Iranian economy is selling oil, and they have to find ways to sort of go around sanctions and sell their oil in a black market. So guess who gets the access to going around the sanctions? People around the state. I mean, they're not going to announce it in the marketplace that, okay, we need people to go around sanctions and sell our oil in the black market. No. They are going to find their own people, their own agents, their own security apparatus to find a way to sell the oil and go around sanctions to function, you know, that otherwise the economy will collapse, you know. So a lot of economic corruption, a lot of form of crony capitalism that exists in Iran is actually related to the imposition of these sanctions. Of course, sanctions, again, stated objective is to put pressure on the government, while in reality, it impoverishes people, and we see the impoverishment of Iranian middle classes and working class who is not paid for months at a time. There are a lot of, you know, strikes in Iran in different industries, that the workers who were not paid for 4 months, for 5 months, because the credit lines were closed, and Iranians cannot get the required currency to pay them, you know. So impoverishment and crony capitalism, and last but not least, it securitizes the society. Because I was talking to a friend of mine at one of the Tehran newspapers, and he was telling me that it's not the case that we don't know there is corruption. It's not the case that we don't know the journalists, that they don't know how they're selling the oil or how they're going around the sanctions. But the question is, if we say that, then that means that we are collaborating with the enemy, because you don't want to tell the Americans how Iranians are going around the sanctions. So in a sense, whatever we say, whatever kind of critique of the state we put forward, automatically we are associating ourselves with the interests of the enemy. So the enemy here is a pretext for a lot of repression in Iran, but it's not only a pretext, because the enemy, as we were talking earlier, the enemy does exist, you know. But the question is, how do you create conditions for this enemy to exploit what's happening in society and to basically plan the overthrow of the regime? But so there are three different dimensions of these sanctions, which is quite important. One is the creation of economic crony capitalism and corruption and impoverishment of people and securitization, totally anti-democratic kind of. And when I told the army chief of intelligence, he was looking at me. I said that, do you know any of this? He said, I can't talk about it. I said that, well, if you don't know about it and you still do it, we are in deep. If you know about it and you still do it, we are in deeper, right? And I didn't tell him that, but
I was internal dialogue.
Internal, you know, I was a little bit kind of intimidated by the director of army intelligence, you know. So I also wanted to say that this is a very, very sad moment. I mean, it's, every day, I honestly dread waking up in the morning and check my computer for news. And it's been quite hard for many of us. And if anyone wants to just talk about what's happening, and even if there is no question, and you just want to share your fears, your frustrations, your concerns, your anxieties, I think this is a good place. At least we can talk a little bit about that as well.
The question was about the U.S. planning for this war with Iran for a very long time, and does Behrouz think that the Iranian state is able to resist this, and for how long?
The short answer is I don't know. But I think for whatever reason, president's advisors have given him the wrong information about the Iranian capacities. I think one of the issues that I was reading today in one of my colleagues' piece, that if you remember, Trump ordered the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani during his first term. And Iranians at that time thought that they do not want to escalate. It was a huge, huge blow to the Iranian security apparatus. And Soleimani was a key general. And Iranians concluded that they don't want to go that route of escalating, because if they do, it's going to be an all-out war between the two countries. They wanted to maintain a period of peace. That moment was misunderstood by the Americans as Iranian weakness. They never thought that Iranians might have been thinking of they don't want to start a war. They thought that, oh, they're so weak that when we assassinate their most important general, they don't respond. And this happened again when Israelis attacked Iranian consulate in Damascus, when Israelis attacked Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, when Israelis assassinated Iranian nuclear scientists. Iranian government showed a possibly, in hindsight, too much restraint, because that restraint was understood as their weakness. And they thought that if they go and bomb Iran, they would immediately capitulate. That experience happened in June, the 12-day war, and they were proven wrong, because they never imagined that Iran could infiltrate Israeli air defense, and they did. And again, this time, they thought that, you know, Iranians are so weak and depleted that they can't mount a resistance, and they're being proven wrong as we speak, because Iran responded in a matter of minutes when they assassinated the supreme leader. How long they can hold it, I have no idea. Can the U.S. destroy all the Iranian missile infrastructure? Possibly. I don't know. It's a very, very hard question to answer. But one thing is clear. The U.S. miscalculated the military strength of the Islamic Republic.
So the question is about being in this difficult moment right now, especially with the diaspora, the Iranian diaspora, many of whom seem to be cheering these attacks on and this war on, and also attacking anyone who is public speaking about the dangers of this war and what it might do to Iran. And how does Behrouz think about that?
Nargis and I were talking before coming here today, and I truly believe that the Iranian majority of the, not all of them, but the majority of Iranian diaspora were abducted by Martians and were transformed, and they send them back to the planet Earth. And
this is the alien problem Trump is talking about.
The alien. We support ICE to deport all these alien Iranians, Martians, you know. But I can tell you how puzzled I am that what is going on, that what's happening with this really highly educated population. Iranians always are so proud, and they say that, you know, we are the most educated minority immigrant community in the whole world and this and that. And then having these kind of bizarre ideas about how the world works, from subscribing to that kind of civilizing mission of the West to basically celebrating bombing of their own neighborhoods in Tehran. I mean, it's just like, it's so puzzling. I can't find a way to wrap my head around what exactly is going on in their minds. I've been giving talks in different parts of California and been talking to some of those Iranian Martians. And they, honestly, they look like zombies, and they can hear. It's really fascinating to me. I have never, ever seen anything like that, that they cannot hear. I talk to them, and it just goes through them, and they don't hear. And it is scary. I mean, I honestly am so scared of what kind of possibilities are there for these people who have lost their connection with reality. And they live in a totally parallel universe like one of my own relatives posted this thing that they're dancing on the streets in one of the North American cities. I don't want to mention the city because then my relative would know I'm talking about them. And then under it, it said that, I wish my friends and relatives in Iran could join us in this dance. You know, like, what? It's, how can you make sense of that? I don't know, you know. And then I think that, you know, the question about what should we do? We should do what we do. You know, we have to be relentless. We have to be resilient. We have to speak up. And we have to try so hard not to make the issue about ourselves. And I've been very, very careful about this, that, you know, people always, you know, attack me and they say that, you know, you are the, apologist of the Iranian regime, this and that. They can say whatever they want. But I'm not going to get into that kind of argument because the issue is not me. And that's very purposeful on their part because they want to distract me and others like me to spend time and focus on our own well-being rather than the real question of the destruction that these policies are causing, the violence in which we find ourselves, not about me, not about us, but about an entire nation. Today, we are talking about an entire nation. So we need to remain focused and do not be distracted by these pressures because that's their objective. We need to be very, very clear about that.
So the question was about mandatory hijab in Iran and what does it mean that today the state is no longer seemingly enforcing it and how does Behrouz sort of think about that issue?
The history behind it is that, you know, it took 3 years after the revolution to finally formalize a dress code for women in Iran and for men as well. But I mean, for men it's very loose, but for women was compulsory hijab, which was basically a head cover and a modest dress. And possibly one of the worst political social policies they adopted after the revolution. It totally alienated half the population, almost half the population, because, you know, even women who observed hijab were puzzled about this. It wasn't an easy policy to implement. That's why it took like 3 years to implement that policy and to codify it. And in so many different ways, this policy had a reflection in society. A lot of people argue that imposing mandatory hijab forced women back to private sphere and locked them inside their homes. In sociological terms, actually mandatory hijab worked the opposite. Because it created a situation in the country that for a lot of very, let's call it traditional families, families who were observant in religion, in their religion, felt completely safe to allow their daughters to enter public sphere. And I do not think that was intended for this law, but I would call that an unintended consequence of that mandatory hijab, that nobody predicted it, created an unprecedented mobility for women in Iranian society. That mobility does not mean that there were not patriarchal laws in the country. Patriarchal laws were there. The gender equality was not recognized in the law. But nevertheless, in practice, a lot of women became, the majority of women became very much involved in social affairs. The number of women, educated women, increased rapidly. I give you just one example that at the time of revolution, only 30% of Iranian women were literate. 20 years after the revolution, that number was risen to 85%. Today, 92% of women in Iran are literate. 60% of university students are women. So we need to kind of have a very sociological analysis of how the imposition of hijab created a different kind of conditions, some of it very repressive, of course, because then it denied many women to choose their own dress, to appear in some public spaces, like, for example, in sports stadiums. And Liverpool never plays in Iran, but if Liverpool shows up in Iran, people, women cannot go see Liverpool. And that's a big tragedy, I know, for people who are... there are a lot of Liverpool supporters in this room, so that's why I make the example of Liverpool. But then, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we have a very mass movement called Women, Life, Freedom that changed all of that. And the states, usually states operate like that. They don't want to admit defeat, but they kind of didn't change the law, but they allowed de facto that people can go in public without hijab. And for all practical purposes, since almost 2 years ago, hijab was not observed in public spaces. So that was a huge, I think, step forward for Iranian women to get to that point of appearing in public without hijab. I also need to say that you know, when we talk about hijab, we are not talking about Taliban in Afghanistan. We are not talking about a cover, you know, that I remember in 1989 or 1990, there was a Friday prayer and the Iranian president said that, you know, we asked women to cover their hair. We didn't ask them to go out in neon signs because they were decorating this headscarf in such a way. It was so glamorous. It was so shiny that was even attracted more attention to women rather than less attraction to women. So people, you know, people push boundaries in so many different ways. And I think one lesson that we learn is that we should not understand a society solely based on textual assertions of law and other texts, you know, because law is there, but the practice of law in society is a totally different kind of phenomenon.
The question was, in 78, 79, folks knew what they didn't want. They didn't necessarily know what they wanted instead. And do you think that this current situation is sort of similar in that way?
It's often the case that when revolutions happen, people don't have a clear idea of what they want. Revolutions are most often are not defined in affirmative terms. The affirmative terms are very general, like social justice, freedom, you know, sovereignty, as I mentioned earlier. But, you know, it's often not the case that exactly they know how are you going to achieve social justice, you know. Revolutions are most often about negation. They want to negate something. And that's true. That was true for 79 revolution, possibly true now, and it was true throughout history that people, it's a sort of a, what we call in my business, negative dialectics, you know.
So she asked about psychological warfare via media operations.
Yeah. I mean, it is so true that it's one of those ironies that whenever I talk to my relatives or friends in Iran and I ask them, so what's going on in Iran? And they say that, you know, this TV station, Iran International, is saying that, which is based in London. I said that, well, I mean, I know what they say in London, but what's happening in Iran? And their source of information has shifted. I mean, I read, my partner is here and she's a witness to that. Every day, like a morning prayer, I read like around 2 hours Iranian newspapers. You know, I know much more about what's happening in Iran than my friends in Iran because they don't pay any attention to Iranian media. And that was the Iran International, possibly was the single most successful propaganda project that the Saudis started, and now Israelis bought it, and they bombard Iran with 24 hours of propaganda. And that has become, unfortunately, the main source of information for many Iranians. And so that's why, you know, that zombie situation is the creation of that. Hundreds of millions of dollars has been spent in the past 20 years through this propaganda machine to change the consciousness of Iranians abroad and inside the country. And that was very successful. And that's very unfortunate. And I think that how we are going to change that, I do not know. But possibly some people would come to their senses after they see the real destruction that that kind of propaganda promotes. I also want to read a short paragraph from the book. So this is the end of the introduction. By the time, this is the third version of the introduction which is published, you know. By the time this book is published, we might be living in a fundamentally different world. It is possible that Iran and the United States could reach an agreement to contain Iran's nuclear technology in exchange for lifting the crippling sanctions the U.S. has imposed against the Iranian people for decades. It is also possible that we could be in the middle of an all-out war between the two countries, a war that without a shred of doubt would engulf the entire region. These are the risks and futilities of writing in these uncertain days. What we write might melt into the air before it is even read, but the roots and conditions of possibility remain. Collecting these essays in this volume is the exercise in exposing what the 21st century order has brought, from the war on terror to today's genocide in Gaza and continuing dismantling of American liberal democracy. I hope to document and unmask the impunity with which this politics of hate and genocide unfold today, to show that despite their claims that these atrocities are committed for the salvation of all, will only lead to the annihilation of others. This is a step forward, realizing the ethos that the great Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci articulated as the pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. The powerful will stay mighty so long as the legitimacy of their acts remained unquestioned and their authority uncontested. Thank you.